Chapter 2. Sheila's Green. By the 1700s, the idea of taking risks for green was taken to new extremes. And there was a new kind of witchery afoot. Science. In 1775, a Swedish chemist named Carl Wilhelm Scheele was doing experiments with arsenic. And one day, he was in his laboratory. I imagine him hunched over his bubbling squash-shaped glass bowls, clouds of gray, milky chemicals fogging his view. When suddenly, out of the corner of his eye,
this extraordinary green paint appeared.
In this moment, Carl Scheele was absolutely stunned. Discovering this perfect grassy shade of green was like stumbling on a mythical treasure. At the time in Europe, the textile industry was expanding rapidly, but no one had quite figured out how to make a cheap, chemically made green to dye mass-produced fabrics. Plant-based dyes weren't cutting it anymore. And according to color historian Victoria Finley, there was a real demand for this color.
You know, there was a whole interest in the natural world. It began to happen just as the Industrial Revolution got into swing. People started to move out of the countryside into the urban areas to work in mills. So a bright green, a beautiful, exquisite kind of emerald-like green was something very attractive.
But Carl Scheele was worried.
And he did write a couple of years later to a friend, I mean, an extraordinary letter really, saying, I wonder whether we should make people aware that this is potentially poisonous. But he didn't.
When Scheele eventually announced his new green color to Europe, there was an explosion of excitement about how amazing it was.
And it became incredibly popular for incorporating elements of the natural world into different elements of design.
That's decorative arts curator Emily Bannis. And because of the lack of bright green pigments on the market beforehand, within the decade, Sheila's green was truly everywhere. It was used to paint fake flowers.
It would have been used in textiles.
It was used to color shoes.
It was used in tendrils on wallpaper.
It was used to dye candle wax, everywhere. For people living in gray, smoggy cities, Sheila's green was the closest thing there was to nature. City dwellers would put up this bright, grassy wallpaper in every room, trying to imitate as best they could the lush, green countryside landscapes that they miss so much. It was as if someone had unfurled strips of sod directly on their walls.
I know that even children's toys were painted in these same green pigments, which was especially problematic when it came to poisonings.
Emily has been researching arsenic wallpaper for over a year now.
To set the scene, when arsenic wallpaper was first being used, people were very used to seeing arsenic and using it in the home for many different purposes. It was readily accessible to buy. It was used in agriculture. It was used in medicine. So the idea that it could be harmful, you know, it took a long time for that to really be instilled in people that actually in these quantities, it could be really dangerous.
And so for a long time, the philosophy around Sheila's green was, as long as you didn't lick it, you would be fine. But problems started to arise.
In 1880, a man called Henry Carr gave a talk to the Royal Society in London, and he announced that one of his young relatives, a boy, after being in a room where his wallpaper, which I think was boys playing cricket on a country scene, had been killed. Another example that he gave of somebody who had almost died was somebody who was ill, who went to the seaside for a rest cure, stayed in, I believe, a hotel where there was this wallpaper. Because it's not just the wallpaper or not just the paint, it's the paint or the wallpaper plus quite a lot of damp. And in the seaside atmosphere where it was damp, that's when the thing came. And a Persian cat locked in a room developed pustules. I mean, it was nasty stuff. And so he said we should stop. You know, the price of this intensely gorgeous colour is too high. And a lot of people were kind of positive, but
there were also people who disagreed.
You know, people probably paid quite a lot of money for these wallpapers, I think all of which amounted to finding it hard to believe that they could be dangerous. I mean, I think it is kind of an odd thing to think about, you know, that something as benign as wallpaper could have any serious effect on somebody's health. You know, if I hadn't have done all the research, I probably would have been like, well, that seems kind of strange. Like, people died because of wallpaper.
But Victoria found that there was another, more surprising reason why people disagreed with Dr. Carr at that Royal Society meeting.
I read on the account of it a letter by a Dr. Thudicum, who said that he thought it was worth it. He said, my eyes are happy to see this colour. We're making too much fuss about nothing.
This colour, this bright, beautiful green, seemed to bring out the worst in people. It made some willing to believe that having it and looking at it were worth any cost, even death. When something so beautiful is right in front of you, it's hard to see it for what it really is.
See, it's complicated, isn't it, these colour connections. You've got red, which is love and hearts, and it's also blood and death. Yellow, happy, gold, kings. Also, you've got bile and sick. We attach what we want to attach, what works for us. It is interesting because this intense green is a chasing of what is natural, and it is utterly corrupt.
Eventually, people across the world accepted that Sheila's green was poisonous, and it was cast aside. But this color ushered in a new modern age where green pigments are mass-produced in factories rather than being handmade from crushed-up plants. And because of that, even today, toxic greens exist. Poisonous substances are used to stabilize pigments made in factories. So popular shades like, for example, Pigment Green 7 and Pigment Green 50 contain chlorine and nickel, which cause birth defects and pollute waterways. Green has become a mythic symbol signaling the natural world. But it's become an empty symbol. And much of humanity has become so wrapped up in its immediate beauty and symbolic gesture that they've neglected the very basis of that symbol, the natural world and life itself.